Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, craft cannabis. New York Small Pharma is working to empower local craft cultivators to grow cannabis under regenerative models, free of pesticides, waste, and harmful byproducts like carbon dioxide. The grassroots organization has just received funding to support the craft cannabis industry in Ulster County. Radio Catskill's Maren Scotton reports. We'll get an update on the Independence Day fireworks in Wayne County. Dear Jack, Dear Louise, the dramatic comedy at Shadowlands Theater that's now running. Plus, pioneering video artist Mary Lucier at Catskill Art Space. Valerie Manzi, culture reporter, speaks to her. That's coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Tonight's the first debate of this election season between President Biden and former President Donald Trump. It's being hosted by CNN. Political consultant Philippe Reines worked with former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. He says the matchup will be one to watch.
You have two men that have not debated in 4 years. Don't like each other, haven't seen each other, pretty rusty, heading into the biggest night of their lives.
There are conditions for the debate. There won't be an audience to cheer and clap for either candidate, and the microphones will be shut off unless one of them is directed to speak. That's intended to limit the candidates from interrupting each other and the moderators. Bolivia's attorney general has launched an investigation into a failed coup attempt yesterday by top leaders of the country's military. The top army commander was taken into custody hours after trying to breach the governmental palace with troops and armored vehicles. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Along with the commander of the army, Juan Jose Zuniga, police arrested a top leader of Bolivia's navy. Shortly after, the defense minister declared everything was, quote, under control. The short-lived military action unfolded on live television as troops moved into the main governmental square of the administrative capital, La Paz. President Luis Arce ordered the general to stand down and installed new military leaders. Bolivia is facing a severe economic crisis and a paralyzing political fight between Arce and the country's popular former leftist president. Arce's opponents accuse him of orchestrating the failed coup to bolster his popularity. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
The National Transportation Safety Board says it is going to sanction aircraft maker Boeing. The NTSB says Boeing broke rules by giving information to the media that was not supposed to be publicized. It was over the blowout of a door plug on a Boeing jet earlier this year. The NTSB says it won't let Boeing have any more information about this during this probe. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Commerce Department reported slightly faster economic growth in the first 3 months of this year. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 5 points in early trading.
Revised figures from the Commerce Department show the U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 1.4% in January, February, and March. Consumer spending was a little bit weaker than had been reported, but government spending and business investment were a little bit stronger. Imports were also revised down. New applications for unemployment benefits fell last week. 233,000 people applied for jobless aid, 6,000 fewer than the week before. The unemployment rate remains historically low. It's been at or below 4% for 2.5 years. Asian stocks were mostly lower overnight. The Japanese yen fell to its lowest level against the dollar since 1986. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is rejecting the U.S. Surgeon General's declaration that gun violence is a public health crisis. The Surgeon General is recommending universal background checks for gun purchases and a ban on assault-style weapons. DeSantis says Florida won't comply because that is government overreach. Dozens of vintage and antique cars are making their way from Kentucky north to Maine. It's in the annual Hemmings News Great Motor Race. From member station WVIA, Kat Bullis reports on the event as it passed through central Pennsylvania.
The race began in 1983 to get the cars out of museums and garages and onto the road. Drivers from around the world take the country's rural and scenic roads. This year started with more than 100 cars in Kentucky.
It's not a speed race, it's a time speed distance rally.
That's Jeff Stumm, race director. About half of the cars were built before World War II. The oldest is a banana-colored 1912 two-seater Haynes, no roof.
It's not a get-there-as-fast-as-you-can type deal.
T.K. Folk drove his dad's 1953 baby blue Cadillac Coupe de Ville. The race stopped in Lewisburg before heading to Binghamton, New York. It finishes in Maine on Saturday. For NPR News, I'm Kat Bolis in Lewisburg.
The San Diego Zoo says it will soon receive a pair of giant pandas from China. They're coming at the direction of the Chinese government. The loan of the giant pandas has long been seen as a tool of diplomacy between the U.S. and China. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Daddy-O, starring Dakota Johnson and Sean Penn. A woman and a cabbie connect and engage in intimate and mysterious conversations during a taxi ride. Now playing only in theaters.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York Small Pharma is a community of farmers and supporters that advocates for socially just, regenerative, and economically inclusive cannabis laws, policies, and regulations in New York State. The group recently won a bid to help Ulster County develop its cannabis economic sector. The county chose just one organization with expertise in cannabis production, sustainability, and social and economic equity that also supports the development of a craft cannabis industry. New York's Small Pharma hopes just to do that, and reporter Maren Scotton spoke to New York Small Pharma president Nicole Ricci.
We are an advocacy organization, so that means we provide education, but we also advocate for certain population within the cannabis industry, and that being social economic equity, small farmer craft cannabis, and we really push low carbon footprint. So considering the environment, considering the community, the workers on the farm, a regenerative approach to both the operation model and cultivation is what we really champion. The concept of regenerative means to improve or at minimum to continue to sustain. And for me, regenerative is really returning to sort of the older, you know, more knowledgeable practices before industrial agriculture took over and had a very input heavy, which became very extractive to the soil. So part of regenerative is also improving the soil, leaving the soil better than where you started. And there's, you know, now this concept of regenerative has spread into regenerative economies, regenerative engineering, regenerative communities. And I think it's really become more sort of, I don't want to say but embracing this concept of sort of a certain list of ethics, I would say. And so really that's what we'd love to see spring up as a new paradigm in an economy to show that you can have a very lucrative economy. That's inclusive economically of your, of anyone who wants to enter it, and not extractive of the community that it's in or the environment that it's placed on.
And tell me a little bit about the bid you guys won through Ulster County, kind of what that process is like and why you're excited about it.
Sure. So the bid that we won with Ulster County, and I have to say, like, props to Ulster County for being really forward thinking and trying to create assistance for the residents in their county, because the state is still writing regulation and the legislation are still putting out new legislation on cannabis. And at the same time, they're also administering licenses. So this industry is being launched. And what Ulster has done is they've provided an opportunity, a place for individuals to be able to pick up the phone and call, ask questions, to, you know, more formally sign up for a one-on-one business counseling, and it's free to residents that meet certain requirements. And if you're interested, you can contact us and we send you just an email with basically a Google form that you fill out that collects data and figures out where you are in your process and how and what services and assistance you need.
Mm-hmm. And how did it feel when you guys won the bid?
Well, I mean, amazing. We're from Ulster and we're really invested. You know, we have a lot of passion about how Ulster develops. There's a lot of really great organizations that are working in Ulster as well, that are, also providing services. So we're just really honored to be able to help Ulster and work with those other organizations that are also in Ulster and the residents of Ulster and helping them sort of navigate their entry into this industry, as well as the municipalities themselves, because a lot of municipalities have questions or their public does. And it's good to be able to provide them general overview information. That's part of what we do, is provide that to the towns and villages and hamlets that would like to hear sort of an overview of what the state has planned for the cannabis industry and what the opportunities are for them and what the regulations are as they stand today.
Yeah, I could imagine like information sharing and just like clarifying a bunch of things would be really important and kind of a huge part of it.
100%. The communication has been one of the biggest things that OCM has criticized about that, and transparency, which are almost one and the same thing. So for sure, being able to provide that communication and, you know, the general overview to the public and to the towns, I think is really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Look forward to the next year or the near future. What does that look like for you guys, and what are some of your top goals?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, the industry is in a really, you know, the community, the regulated cannabis community is in a really nascent stage, as are these concepts of incubators and assistance. And so I think what I like to see happen over the next couple of years is have some foundational pieces of policy and science put in place to have understanding of geographic significances of cultivation outdoors, Appalachian, so to speak, and have a scientific approach to that and geographic regions and seeing cannabis in New York sort of known for the region that it comes from, I think are great goals for the Mid-Hudson in general.
Are there any specific policies that you guys are pushing for, supporting right now?
It's a struggle to be a small business and try to start in this industry. And then when you enter into the regulated field, you're really constrained and restricted in what you can do. You can't, you know, any little thing, any little change that you want to do to your operation, you have to sort of get approval for. And it can really slow and mire the process. You know, anyone who does have a license in the Mid-Hudson, like, please feel free to reach out and get in contact with us, because we'd really love to see, to bring together a network of the craft small businesses. You know, the micro businesses aren't allowed to work cooperatively through the regulations. So, you know, which is great, because then we can work communally. You know, we can come together as a community and meet each other and see who has what resources and help each other out and swap stories and form, you know, be a coalition, a voice, a coalition as well when you're, you know, because some of the regulations that they do have in place are very not conducive to being a small business. They don't really necessarily assist it in any way. I think if you come together in community and figure out, share and, you know, even hold space for each other, it definitely helps. Definitely helps improve things. So yeah, hopefully people come out. We'd love to have a pool meeting together of the small craft farmers in the Hudson Valley. And anyone in Ulster who is interested or have questions can reach out to us. We have an email, incubator@nysmallpharma.org. You can send any questions regarding assistance with wanting to get a license or going through the license process or starting once you do get your license.
That was Nicole Ricci, the president of New York Small Pharma, on their win in a bid to help Ulster County develop its cannabis economic sector. In Liberty, I'm Maren Scotton for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, fireworks will soon be lighting up the sky for July 4th in Wayne County. We'll get the where, when, and why after this break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Can two people with different political beliefs still have a meaningful conversation? I'm Ronald Kelson, and I'm working with Radio Catskill on StoryCorps One Small Step, bringing strangers and our community together, one conversation at a time. We are having conversations in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania all year long, and you should be a part of it. Sign up now at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're with Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. July 4th is next week. Can you believe it? Two of Wayne County's most viewed July 4th fireworks displays take place over Irving Cliff in Honesdale and Lake Wallenpaupack near Hawley. Here to tell us about where you could see them and how you could help support are Sandy Levins from Greater Honesdale Partnership and Debbie Gillette, Chamber of the Northern Poconos. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sandy, as I said, can you believe July 4th is next week? When are the fireworks over Irving Cliff in Honesdale this year?
Time flies when you're having fun, right? So coming up Monday, July 1st is our fireworks celebration in Honesdale. They do shoot them up from Irving Cliff, but you can view them really anywhere in the Honesdale area. Probably one of the most popular places is right at our Central Park. There'll be music and starting at 6:30. So it's just a nice day in Honesdale right in Central Park, and then wait for the fireworks.
Yeah, you know, I'm lucky enough to live kind of high up, actually, over here in Calicoon on the New York side, but we face that way, and we always, every year, can tell when the Honesdale fireworks are going off, because it's a huge display. It's great.
Yeah.
I mentioned in the beginning that people can support the fireworks. You guys rely on some resident community support to put them on, too, right? How can people support?
Yeah, absolutely. We have lots of sponsors this year, and it's been great. But we do have on our website, which is visithonesdalepa.com, you can go under support and donate to the fireworks and just keep so we can have another great celebration. Keep them going.
Yeah. And you mentioned that in Central Park that evening, there's some music and other stuff. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on there?
Sure. The Wayne County Arts Council provides music, free music in the park, starts at 6:30. They're going to have vendors and food trucks, so a whole pre-celebration before the fireworks go off. So it's a fun family day. You can come down, bring a lawn chair, bring a blanket. The music this year is the Doug Smith Band, Crystal Band. So it's just a fun day to start at 6:30 and then, you know, wait for dark for the fireworks to take off.
And Debbie, the Wallenpaupack fireworks are on July 4th. Sandy mentioned that the Irving Cliff fireworks in Honesdale are on the 1st, so we'll get something earlier in the week. And then the traditional July 4th fireworks, you guys always have them on that day, right?
We always have them on the 4th of July.
Yeah, and why is that tradition such a tradition for you guys?
It is a tradition for us because naturally it is Independence Day and it's the big birthday celebration of the United States of America. So we always have them on the 4th with a rain date of the 5th.
And where do you think that folks can best view your display?
Oh, there's lots of opportunities for viewing. They are shot off from the softball field at the Wallenpaupack Area High School. So that's actually like kind of down below the football stadium. So you can see it at the high school. We have the stadium seating, of course, by boat. There are several areas around the lake. You can go up to the overlook on Route 590 or to the Tafton Overlook Dike on Route 6 and 507. But basically almost any area around the lake, you would be able to view the fireworks. They're shot up pretty high.
And are there any concerns about parking or what people should know about parking and when they're going around the lake there?
Absolutely. We want to stress there is absolutely no parking along Route 6, 507, or 590. We have to keep all that clear so there's no parking along the fog lines. Come park at the high school or the district office. Once we run out of space there, across the street on Atlantic Avenue are the intermediate, the primary, and the elementary schools. So there's lots and lots of parking there. So there's really not that many issues if you want to come to the school area to view the fireworks.
And as I mentioned, Sandy and I were talking about how people support the fireworks, you also rely on some community support there as well.
Absolutely. Our fireworks are put on 100% by donations. The area businesses are very, very generous to keep this display going every year. And ours is a little bit different than Sandy's because of the logistics of where they're shot off. So we have to have a lot of security, a lot of traffic control. There's a lot of things that go into the fireworks, just don't go up in the air. So
yeah.
There's a lot of other things that go along with it that we have to adhere to, and working with several different entities to make sure everyone's safe.
Well, I have to ask while I have you both, is there any kind of competition, you know, between the two of you, who has the bigger, better fireworks display?
Absolutely.
I'm going with no. No, no, no. I'm always excited, actually, for Wallen Pop after Honesdale. You'll find me at the Wallen Pop one. So it's a great week of celebration. So, you know, I think we complement each other very well.
Oh, I think we lost Debbie there, but I heard her say that, yes, there is no competition as well. But, yeah, all week long, we've got the Honesdale fireworks happening on Monday the 1st, and then the Wallen Pop Pack fireworks are on the 4th. If you want to learn more about those displays, go to visit honesdalepa.com or northernpoconos.org for more information. Sandy Levins from the Greater Honesdale Partnership, thank you so much. And Debbie Gillette, I don't know where you are, but thank you, from the Chamber of Northern Poconos. Thank you both, and happy 4th.
Thank you. You too.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Shadowlands Theater's current production, Dear Jack, Dear Louise, will speak to the lead in the play next.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End, and you can join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I explore the deep end of the catalogs of bands maybe you know, maybe you don't know. You'll hear some Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, Government Mule, right alongside bands like the Electric Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Kula Shaker, and Supergrass. That's The Deep End each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight right here on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's Electric Mountain, featuring the very best of global dance music. I play the best of dance music from back in the day to today, and every week I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain each and every Saturday night, 12 to 2, exclusively on Radio Catskill.
You're back with Radio Chatskill. When two strangers meet by letter during World War II, a love story begins. U.S. Army Captain Jack Ludwig, a military doctor stationed in Oregon, begins writing to Louise Rabiner, an aspiring actress and dancer in New York City, hoping to meet her someday if the war will allow. That's the plot of Ken Ludwig's dramatic comedy Dear Jack, Dear Louise, currently playing at Shadowlands Theater, running through July 7th. Michael Liebhauser stars as Captain Jack Ludwig, and Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke to him just after opening weekend.
So let's talk about this play. You were talking on a Tuesday morning, and over the weekend you had the opening of this play. How was that experience?
Opening night was a phenomenal experience. I think with a lot of plays, but especially with comedies, and especially a show like this, getting an audience in to actually be making up the sort of third character in the play for us is a huge milestone, and was a pretty transformative thing. Over the course of the preview performances we did, I felt like the play really finally came into its own and came to life. And I think that's sort of a natural symptom of doing a show where there's just two people on stage reading letters, not even particularly to each other. Alexander and I are, you know, we're reacting to one another and we're engaged with one another, but we're not really in the same scene in the way that you are normally in a play, because you're not playing to the person live. You're sort of playing to the audience. And finally getting to have an audience in, and especially the audiences we've had so far have just been phenomenal and so engaged and so willing to come on the ride with us. It's been really transformative and delightful.
Now, you play Captain Jack Ludwig. Can you share with us initially what sort of drew you to the character? Obviously, you auditioned and got the part. But what sort of aspects of this character personally resonates with you?
I'm quite a gregarious person. I'm quite outgoing, outspoken. I'm always sort of happy to engage with things, even if I'm really bad at them. And Jack is the polar opposite. He is reserved, he is neurotic, he is nervous, but he is also ferociously intelligent, but he's intelligent in a very narrow band. He's a doctor, he's a surgeon, he's a soldier. By the end of the war, he's a very skilled trauma medic. And I think that it's really fascinating to engage with characters whose brains work really differently to yours. I think that's always one of the most fun things you get to do as an actor, is not just explore the people who behave differently than you, but are ultimately quite similar to you in very strange circumstances, but the people who behave as you would not, because they are built just different to you. And that was the thing that drew me Jack when I started working on the project.
How do you prepare for a role like this? Is there how much, you know, obviously there's pre-production with the rest of the cast, with the director, but yourself, how much of preparedness do you go to a character? How long does it take you to, you know, memorize your lines or things like that?
It's different for every play. It's different for different projects and different lengths of rehearsal. This play, I felt it was really important for me to physically write out all of the lines in the show, which is something I often do. It's usually the first step I take, is I write out or type out everything, but I almost always use, you know, I almost always use a word processor. I almost always use a keyboard. And for this show, because Jack is handwriting letters, and he's handwriting letters, and that's the only thing that he's actually saying throughout, what, 99% of the show, I felt that it was important that I did that, both to have the experience of what it feels like to physically write the thing out and to think in the way that you do when you're writing a letter, which is a slower, more deliberate way of discovering what you mean. But I also have always found that if I write something down, it's easier for me to memorize it. And that's something I stole. There was some interview with Christopher Lloyd talking about Danny DeVito on the set of Taxi. And apparently you'd be walking on the set and there'd be all these handwritten pages in DeVito's handwriting where he'd just been writing out his lines furiously. And that was how he memorized. Mm-hmm. And I learned about that when I was really, really young. I think my dad told me that story when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and I thought, oh, that's good, I'll steal that. But this show was a really interesting thing to memorize, because so much of the action is just sitting and reading, and I didn't even clock for myself how much of my process of memorizing things was tied to motion, tied to physical action on stage. Since there's less of it, it was much more challenging.
Right, yeah, you talk about that. You're sometimes reading the letters on your own, and dear Jack, dear Louise, you know, your character sort of communicates, you know, his personal emotions through letters. You know, I mean, you could talk a little bit more about that. How do you sort of prepare to convey, like, intimacy and sincerity without the physical presence of your counterpart during much of the play?
Yeah, it's different to what we're usually doing as actors, which is engaging with someone who's right in front of us and like, you can touch. But I think that it's not a difficult imaginative thing. I mean, you and I right now, we're on a phone line. We're not in the same room. We can express intimacy to each other. We could express a full range of emotions to each other. I often, my partner of 10 years is also an actor. And most of the time, I would say at least 8 months out of the year, we are far away from each other, separated by often multiple states. At present, half a continent. We write emails, we send letters, we text, we talk. All of that is the same thing that Jack and Louise are doing, trying to express intimacy across this barrier of time and space. What I think is really interesting about it, and what actually made it very accessible to me, is that I think that Jack and Louise are asking themselves that same question. I think if you're sitting down to write a letter to someone that you've never met, but you think you might be falling in love with, you have to be asking yourself, how do I express this? How do I show you how I feel about us, about you, about who I am to you, when all I have is a couple pages of stationery and a pen and a half hour before I have to go back out and keep drilling on this army base? And I think that the reality of the character's question so neatly mirrored my own question of, like, how do I do this? That it was actually, ultimately, it was quite a simple thing to at least feel connected to, if not the simplest thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is all happening in the backdrop of World War II, and I just, when, as you were talking, I was just thinking about how would it look in modern times? You know, you're sending a text or email, and it's almost an immediate sort of letting go of your emotions, but also you get that reaction from the other person sometimes within a day or a couple of minutes. And this time in World War II, you're writing a letter. You have to go to the post office. You have to mail it. It may take, especially if he's on the front, you could talk about months or weeks for the other person to get it and for you to get a response. And what you have to go through during that time, waiting for a response or waiting for the other person to respond to what you said. That's really interesting just to think about that, how times have changed and how we communicate with each other.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the most beautiful parts about the play for an audience is that, and for me performing it, is that it is so different. And especially the backdrop of World War II is so specific. And, you know, what he's going through in between each letter, you know, the battle at Okinawa and the battle at Attu and, like, all of these things that are happening just sort of off stage that he's a part of. All of that is wildly different to us. But the thing that's at the core of it, which is two young people getting acquainted, finding something magnetic and magical inside of one another, and then discovering that they can't actually live without it. That's so universal. And even through the, you know, this play could not be written in this way today because, you know, you can hop on a FaceTime call. Like they'd have phones, they'd be able to text. There wouldn't be, you know, there wouldn't be this great question of, like, oh my God, what do you even look like? I think I'm in love with you. But the core of it, of trying to find a way to express affection, of trying to find out what it means to you when you discover that you're in love, that's, time has not changed what that's like.
Yeah, I always wonder about a lot of these productions that are written in the past and how it would translate to today's audience and how would you write it, you know, like even like the funniest, like the Seinfeld episode where George is going back and forth with voicemail with his girlfriend and he's trying to break up with it. You know, how would that be take place now in the day of texting and, you know, emails, stuff and things like that. So, I'm assuming you're in production. And then opening night happens. Does that change anything for you as how you respond to your own character now that you're in an actual, the play has opened up and you're in the real production now in front of audiences? Does that change anything for you?
Yeah, I think it's a gargantuan change that occurs usually in the first couple of weeks of a performance. You have to learn how to respond to the audience, and you learn how the audience is responding to your character. And some of that is really simple and mechanical. Like when the audience laughs, you got to shut up. You got to stop talking, let them laugh. And then, you know, time out when the crest of the laugh is, and now you can start your next line so that everyone can hear what you're saying. That adds something totally new to the production, which is that it's the pace that we've gotten so used to, because there's just two of us, on stage. We ran this show, I don't know, a dozen times. Like, we ran through the whole thing many, many, many more times than you would typically get to, which was phenomenal. But we got really used to one another's rhythms. I got really used to how long it took Alexandra to say lines. And that's not how long it takes when there's an audience, because they laugh and they react and there are gasps and people cry and people, you know, say things and it catches us by surprise. And that's, you know, that's so phenomenal, but that's a huge change. And I think that learning night after night from what you can hear the audience doing, what you can feel the audience doing, learning what an audience thinks of your character changes for you how you are approaching them. Because, you know, there's things that you want to reinforce and things that you don't. I've been very lucky. I've gotten to play some real terrible villains in my career. And there's something, you know, really exciting about doing something awful and feeling the entire audience recoil from you. But that's a reaction that you're trying to modulate. You're trying to sense, okay, do people see me as villainous here? Do they know that this is, you know, a major transgression? And we have the same thing in a much more lighthearted way with Dear Jack, Dear Louise, of like, can we feel the audience tracking the first time we say the word love in a letter? Can we feel them tracking the danger that Jack is in when he gets shipped out for the front? Can we feel the audience tracking Louise's triumphs and failures and frustrations as an actress? And that's not something that you can, it's not something you can rehearse. You have to do it. It's the magnificent thing about theater, is that it doesn't actually come to life until there are people in the seats. And because it is a necessarily impermanent, unfixed medium, you get to re-experience it every evening from the stage with a brand new group of people who've never seen it before, and they don't know what's coming, even though you do. And it lets you experience it new again and again and again. That's certainly my experience of that transformation.
Yeah. So it's talking about the audience. What do you hope audiences would take away from this production? Is there any particular like a message or feeling you want them to leave with?
I think that this is a very hopeful show. I think you're watching two people for whom the stakes could not possibly be higher, doing something that for, I think, most of us is so ordinary and so high stakes, which is falling in love. It is, I don't know that there's another thing you do in your life, aside from falling for someone, that costs you so much in terms of stress and joy and worry. The emotional down payment is of a tremendous magnitude, but is ultimately so rewarding and so fulfilling. And getting to watch people do that is really tremendous. I also think that these are two people against a backdrop of a world in the throes of war, of conflict, of hatred, of bitter recriminations, and of tremendous uncertainty for the future. And the fact that they determine that life for them is just going to go on, that they are going to see each other as this little candle against the darkness and protect it. I think that's so beautiful. And I think that's so wonderful. And I think that's something that we can always stand to be reminded of.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Michael, before we go, is there anything else I have not touched on you want folks to know about?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, if I may, just for a moment, My castmate, Alexandra Fortin, I think is doing just some of the most phenomenal work across from me every night. She is titanic in scope. And Louise is such a massive character who has to do these, like, some of her monologues are almost arias in the scope of them and the size of them. And if people come to this show for nothing else, come watch this woman work, because she is really, really incredible.
We're talking to Michael Lieberhauser. He's in a play called Dear Jack, Dear Louise, which has opened already at the studio at Shadowland Stages, and it runs all the way to July 7th. For more information, visit shadowlandstages.org. Michael, thank you so much for talking to me on this play. Again, it's really interesting to hear the process of an actor and what you have to go through to prepare for a role. So again, thank you so much for doing this, and break a leg from the rest of the production.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, pioneering video artist Mary Lucier at Catskill Art Space. Her exhibit traces the breadth of her career, from her experiments with early video camera technology of the 1970s to recent installations reflecting on her personal lived experience and loss of her late husband and painter, Robert Berland. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks to her next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Mary Lucier is an American visual artist and pioneer in video art. Concentrating primarily on video and installation since 1973, she's produced numerous multiple and single channel pieces that have had a significant impact on the medium. Catskill Art Space is presenting an exhibition of her video art through August 24th. It's a sweeping exhibition, and it marks the first time the organization has exhibited video art. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Mary Lucier.
Good morning, Mary, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Your work is in video and sound installation. Can you tell us a little bit about how you embarked on that particular medium?
Well, when I was in college back in the 1960s, I began to focus on sculpture towards the end of my college years. And I also became involved with a number of composers who worked in the new music scene at the time. And I evolved from the several disciplines that I studied in college, being literature and sculpture, primarily, evolved and then into photography after I graduated.
Wow.
I studied photography briefly. And finally, all of those things came together as video installation. And I think I did my first video work probably in the 1971, 72.
Mm-hmm.
But before that time, I had already done a lot of photography and been involved in a lot of performance art as well.
Tell us a little bit about the performance art you were involved in.
Well, I actually married a composer. I was a child bride, you see. I married the composer Alvin Lucier, which is where my last name comes from. And he, being a fairly renowned avant-garde composer, got me involved in the medium. And for about 10 years, I performed with him and his, his compatriots, mm-hmm. in a group called the Sonic Arts Union. And we performed in Europe, and we performed all over the United States.
Whoa.
And established quite a reputation as a performing arts group with this very avant-garde focus.
Which included music, dance, performance?
Primarily music,
uh-huh.
and performance. Now, the four men who were involved in this were Alvin Lucier, Robert Ashley, David Behrman, and Gordon Mumma, all of whom are composers. And each of them had a wife. This was the 60s, remember?
Yes.
Each of them had a wife who was also an artist One was a dancer, and three of us were visual artists. And so we accompanied the group on its tours and occasionally performed our own work, but mostly we performed together as a group. The men's, you know, we worked on the men's compositions. So it was very exciting.
I bet. What was it that drew you to video art?
Well, it was, can I say the happening thing?
Sure. Of course. I remember. I mean, I remember it. So, yeah, it was the happening thing.
Nam June Paik and Wolf Vostell sort of invented the medium of video art in Germany in the late 60s.
Uh-huh.
And Paik then moved to the United States and brought with him the very first portable video camera.
Uh-huh.
And he landed in New York and started this movement. In some sense, he was the grandfather to all of us. Although not very many of us went on to emulate his work exactly, but Nam June as a personality was fantastic. He was brilliant. He was funny. He was witty. He really pioneered this whole field. And today his work sells for a great deal of money, though he unfortunately is deceased.
Mm-hmm.
But he got it going, and we all owe him a debt of gratitude.
And from there?
Say that video art began to subdivide into different categories,
uh-huh.
which is normal, I think, in any art field.
Sure.
Fortunately, we didn't have the burdensome history of, say, painting or sculpture. So women, I think, felt freer in that medium. There was no history of great video artists. There was only Nam June to begin with. And so women going into that, entering that field, entered usually from filmmaking, from literature, from dance and other forms of performance, finding video art to be this incredible medium that could combine all of the interests you had, whether it was literary, movement, art, audio, performance, all of those things came together in video. And that was what was so intriguing about it in the late 60s, early 70s.
It's interesting how you're kind of presenting how women became involved as a new medium, because I remember in the history of film, in the early days, women were very involved as writers and performers and directors. And at some point that changed.
I was young in the medium of video, I was, in fact, not interested in film. I had never studied film, didn't care particularly about filmmaking. But there were other women artists at that time. Shirley Clarke was one. You might cite Charlotte Moorman, who performed with Paik. There were a number of mm-hmm. women who bridged both film and video. But when video emerged, to tell you the honest truth, the filmmakers hated us.
I'm sure.
The medium was so low resolution compared to what you could get with, say, 16-millimeter film. I didn't know anybody who worked in 35-millimeter. Mm-hmm. That was Hollywood. So 16-millimeter was about as high as you could get. And then 8-millimeter film came along and was the choice of young avant-garde filmmakers. And those two movements existed side by side for years until the digital changes happened. And now people refer to digital art as film. I don't. I still think video and film are separate entities. But, you know, these things become meshed up. They become mashed in culture. And there's a whole new language now because of the internet and because of our cell phones regarding film and video.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you'll be showing at the Catskill Art Space?
I'm showing two large video installations and a selection of photographs. One of the video installations actually dates from 1979, and it is called Equinox. This was a piece that showcases what I was interested in at the time, which was the fallibility of video. The fact that inside the video camera at that time, there was a tube, just a regular, vacuum tube. And it could be burned if you aimed it at an extremely bright light. So if you aimed that camera at the sun would burn a scar onto the internal tube of the camera, and it was permanent. It was like a scar of a trauma, like the encounter of the medium with the sun. It was too powerful for the medium, right?
Got it.
So I was intrigued by that, and I thought, rather than try to make something that was either dramatic, literary, or beautiful, that I would examine this fallibility in the camera and the medium. And I started a whole series of video pieces where I intentionally burned the Vidicon tube inside the camera in very deliberate ways. And Equinox was one of them. I had started by making a piece called Dawn Burn, which was made in 1975, where I aimed the camera at the sun for 7 successive days, looking across the East River in New York City as the sun rises from dawn until for 30 minutes elapse. And that piece is now in the collection of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. And then I continued to make works like that. There was another piece called Paris Dawn Burn, which was recently shown by my gallery in London. And now I'm reviving this piece called Equinox, which was the last of the series and the first one that I made in color. All the previous works using this technique or using this flaw were black and white. But Equinox was the first to be done in color in 1979. And what interests me about it now, when I look at it, is the color. The color looks like, to me, like something's wrong with the planet. When we recently had the Canadian wildfires,
yes,
smoke came down to New York City and New York State, and the sky got so gritty and dirty and orange, right?
Yes.
And I look at now at this piece, Equinox, and I think, that's what it looks like.
Wow.
But was I forecasting the future? So to me, it's interesting again. In its original time, it was interesting to me as a way to use a flaw of the technology to exploit it for what I considered aesthetic purposes. Now, I look at it as a commentary on the sun itself and how we view it and what's happening on the planet, which is something I could not have anticipated.
That's, I suppose, one of the exciting aspects of it. And can you tell us a little bit about the other work you'll be showing?
Sure. There's a second installation. I should add that Equinox is seven channels. That is, it is 7 distinct video files, videotapes, played on 7 old-school CRT Sony Trinitron monitors of increasing sizes from number 1 to number 7 and displayed in an arc. And they run for 33 minutes until the cycle is finished and it restarts, plays all over again. The other piece is called Leaving Earth, and it's recent. I made it in the past couple of years. And I date it 2024.
Okay.
It's 9 channels of video and sound, which is a fair number, of contemporary Samsung monitors on poles, on these austere black poles. Uh-huh. And it is derived from my experiences here in Sullivan County and my late husband's and my residence and studios here and in our life in New York City, the two. And it was, I guess it was inspired by reading his journal after he died in 2015, where I got to extract these sort of nuggets of either, I don't know if you're, wisdom, I suppose you could call them, comments, thoughts that he had about dying. He knew he was dying, and we knew he was dying. It was foretold from the very beginning, from the moment of diagnosis.
Yes.
We knew that this cancer was deadly. And so he spent the next year and a half coping with it and preparing. And so this piece essentially is about that, and it includes quotes from his journals and along with images from these two landscapes that we both lived and worked in.
Well, what a wonderful tribute to him and to your relationship. Is there anything else you would like to add before we conclude?
Well, I think the obvious thing is, what is the connection between these two pieces? And I have to say, my work has probably always been somewhat about death and dying, even if it doesn't look like it at first. Ultimately, that is what I think the message that comes through is, that these are meditations on death. And from 1979 to 2024, the same theme persists, but in a different form. And that is one of the things that excites me about being able to show these two pieces from two entirely different eras of work.
Can you share with our listeners your website where folks can see some of your work?
Sure. It's Mary Lucier.net.
And that's L-U-C-I-E-R.
Correct.
Thank you, Mary, and I look forward to meeting you next Saturday.
Hey, thank you very much.
Same here.
Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to video artist pioneer Mary Lucier. More information about that exhibit at Catskill Artspace at catskillartspace.org. And a program note, tonight marks the presidential debate. President Biden and former President Trump take the stage tonight in the first presidential debate of the election season. It's the earliest general election debate in modern history, and this time there are a few rules. Join us for live special coverage and analysis of the CNN presidential debate simulcast on NPR News starting at 9 tonight here on Radio Catskill. And a reminder to go to our website, wjffradio.org, where you can also stream that debate if you want to listen to it over the internet or on your phone. Go to the website, check out One Small Step. That is our partnership with StoryCorps. We're pairing people together with different beliefs to have a conversation, bringing strangers together to find the humanity in all of us. And we would like for you to participate. You can find out how. Go to wjffradio.org. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Bethelwood Center for the Arts, presenting an evening with James Taylor and his all-star band tomorrow. Ticket information at bethelwoodcenter.org. New this year, camping and glamping on the historic site of the 1969 Woodstock Festival.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. As immigration and the border take center stage in this campaign season, we're going to take you to Sasabe, Mexico, a town in the shadows of the border wall where the locals have been forced to flee because of cartel violence.
We are in a war. There is gunshots all over these mountains. We don't know what's happening.
This week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
It can be hard to let your mind wander sometimes, to learn about something new, or to get fully engrossed in somebody else's story. That's where NPR comes in.
It takes a long time to create a fairy tale.
He was both a Jesuit priest and a jazz manager.
As soon as I saw the subject, I thought, oh my God, this is it.
Invest in deep, human storytelling today by giving to this station.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. Livingston Manor, ny.com. and listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Local news, culture, and NPR, this is Radio Catskill. Today's weather, not as warm, lower humidity, sun and some clouds, a high of 76, clear, low 49 tonight. Tomorrow, sunny and nice, 74 for the high, and looking ahead, thunderstorms in the area Saturday morning through Sunday afternoon. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.